Okay, welcome everyone. So it's an honor to have you here at Cedar Sinai. We've been communicating a lot by email over the last 2 years, but good to finally have Rabbi Bunny back in the hospital. Thank you, Rabbi Union and the RCC, for helping to make this happen. Rabbi Steinberg will share some of the recent contemporary shilas that he's been dealing with, some interesting issues, and then we'll definitely have plenty of time also for question and answer, so think about what you want to ask him. This is a great opportunity. I just thought maybe just a couple of very brief words. So I think we all recognize and respect who we have with us today, but just to emphasize that, I'll just tell you 2 points. One was a kind of a funny story that happened with me last week that's just a reminder of who Rabbi Steinberg is. There was an Indian in medical halacha that I was looking into, and I was researching, and I was interested in, and I found the tshuva in the Tzitz Eliezer. And it was right on the topic I was looking at. And as I'm reading the tshuva, I had a lot of kashas, a lot of questions, things that weren't clear to me, and things that I was concerned about as I was reading the tshuva. And I finished the tshuva, and I had notes of questions. I thought to myself, Rabbi Steinberg's coming next week. I'll go over the tshuva with him, because I have all these questions. So then in the Tzitz Eliezer, the very next tshuva says, Od b'inyan hanal. They wanted someone else, you know, also had questions. So I'm reading, you know, in the Tzitz Eliezer, in his tshuvas, he always prints the shoel, their question in full, and then he gives his answer. So I'm reading the shoel, and I see it's all my kashas, but actually much sharper, much deeper, and more kashas that I didn't think of. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. Someone else had my kasha too. And then I finish reading the questions, and then Tzitz Eliezer responds, and he writes, Lichvod harofe hamefursam, Tamar Chacham Gadol, Yirei Shemayim, Harav Hagon, Professor Harav Avram Steinberg Shlita. And I thought, okay, clearly someone asked these questions way before me. This was almost 40 years ago. I think this tshuva was written. And I thought, amazing, Hashkacha Pratis, that I had this question. And Dr. Steinberg, Rabbi Steinberg already asked the question many decades before. And the Tzitz Eliezer was very close with him, gave him his tshuva. And we know that many, many posts came throughout the generations in recent years, have been close with Rabbi Steinberg. And last month, I had a chance to visit Eretz Yisrael. I was in the hospitals in Israel visiting and learning what they do there. So I met with the Rabbanim in each hospital, in Shari Tzedek, and Maine Yeshua, and Bnei Brak, and Tel HaShomer, Sheba Hospital in Tel Aviv, where they have actually a men's mikvah in the hospital, which is fascinating, the only hospital in the world with a men's mikvah. Just fascinating, all the hospitals, just really interesting the way they're applying halacha today. And so I spent the day with the rabbis, and one of my questions for each rabbi was, you know, who's your posek? Not that I'm trying to grill them, that I want to know, who are the posek? People are asking today, the big shilas, right? Who's your posek? Who do you call? So each one gave me a different one, Rav Moshe Shaul Klein, Rav Amar, Rav Zilberstein, Rav Asher Weiss. Each one had a different posek, right? Today in Klal Yisrael, everyone has a different posek that they go to. But then as I'm talking to them, I always said to them, okay, but I push a little more. How do you deal with your shilas? How do you research them? I want to know how they do their jobs as rabbis in their hospitals. And every single one said to me, so I have my posek, who I ask my shilas to, and when I need to research a topic, I have Rabbi Dr. Steinberg's svarim, and oftentimes I'll email him and call him. So they each had a different posek, but they all have the same scholar, Rabbi Gadol, who they turn to. And I just thought it was amazing that in all these different worlds, and all around the world, in fact, Rabbi Steinberg, for many decades now, and should have Arichas Yamin to continue guiding us for many, many more years, is such a prominent and important figure that we turn to for so many important things. So it's really a kavod gadol to be able to welcome Professor Rabbi Steinberg back to Cedar Sinai. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's always embarrassing, such eulogies, when people talk. I'm not there, and half of it you can erase, it's okay. I remember when I went to see Reb Shlomo Zalman, and I discussed with him an issue, and it usually was something new and maybe complicated, so I went home, and as long as it was still fresh in my mind, I wrote what I understood from his tshuva, and I used to drop it in his mailbox. And after a few days, he usually would call me. He didn't have secretary. He's not Mashkebakim and no other person. He used to call himself, said, Kan medaber Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and that's how he communicated. And he used to call me if he had what to remark on what I wrote. But how do you write to Shlomo Zalman? You can't write Lechvod Arav Shlomo Zalman, right? You write Lechvod Rashka Bahag, Moifes Ador, Poisek Ador, blah, blah, and Shlomo Zalman. So invariably, when he showed me what he wrote on my letter that I summarized, the first thing, he erased all the Toharim. He bothered to erase it. But he left Harav HaGaon. So I said, Torah v'lilmod anitzarich. If already you're erasing all the titles, why HaGaon you are leaving? So he said, nowadays everyone is a goy. So it's not a sign of chshivas. Anyway, I thought that best would be maybe to open it to discussion, but Rabbi Weiner suggested that I'll tell you a few of the recent issues that I'm involved, and maybe something of more practical approach, and then we can open for discussion. So, to begin with, Potchin B'Kvod Achsan Yatchila, and it really, I'm very grateful to Rabbi Maskin and to Rabbi Weiner for inviting me to be here this week and over Yontef, and really it's a great pleasure to be here again and to talk to you, and maybe I can be of some help to someone. So let me start. I'll present two cases, and it's not that I know all the answers, but just you should understand the different issues that come up, and it's not necessarily brain death and organ transplants and fertility treatments. There are more mundane questions that are very difficult sometimes to decide. But I thought that it was mentioned by passing the issue of a respirator in a dying patient. So, as we all know, there are many patients who don't die naturally. They always get to the hospital. First thing that there are some trouble, they are intubated. Before you know what's happening, they are already intubated. Now, obviously, if you wait too long, then it will be too late. So you have to do it on an emergency basis. Many times, Atzole whoever comes even to the house already intubates the patient because he doesn't have time to think if he wanted it, he didn't want, if the situation is appropriate for intubation or not. He's intubated, now he comes to the hospital. And many times turns out that either the person had an advance directive that he doesn't want to be intubated, but no one had the time and the presence of mind to find a piece of paper and let the physicians know. Sometimes there's no time to look over it and see if it's authentic, if it's correct, if the circumstances are the ones that really he intended not to be intubated. All these discussions, sometimes we just don't have time, so the default is to intubate. But then he, quote-unquote, is stuck on the machine. What do you do then? So, lehaloche, almost all poskim, I won't go into the fine machloikesen, but almost all poskim, certainly the major leading poskim, say that sometimes you're allowed to withhold intubation. If the patient is really dying and suffering and he didn't want it and you know it, so you can withhold. It's a sheval tase, and sheval tase, there's no chiyuv. Avosner even said that there is a chiyuv of lo tamod al dam recho, and you see him dying and you can save his life for a day, for a month, for a week by intubating. But he said that is not lo tamod al dam recho, where the recho doesn't want it even. It's not something that you're doing him a favor by prolonging his life. But even without this pshat, Almost every poisek agrees that in case of suffering and no chance and just prolonging suffering, one is allowed to withhold. But once it comes to withdrawing, which is an act of kumvase, which is clear that if the patient is dependent on the respirator and you will disconnect him from the respirator, you'll do an act that will kill him, that will hasten death. And that, according to almost all poskim, is forbidden. So are there any options to help such situations? And that comes up almost daily in hospitals and in practices. So there are at least four different options that could be taken into account. One option is that sometimes such a patient who is intubated is becoming better. He was intubated because he had pneumonia and you treated it and he is breathing a little bit better on his own. And legitimately, the physician suggests to wean the person off the respirator as a medical indication, not in order to kill him, not in order to stop it so that he'll die, but in order to see if he can stay without the respirator. If it is done legitimately, and one has to be very careful because sometimes physicians think that enough is enough, and in the American society, withdrawing a respirator is as easy as withholding. They don't make the distinction between Shev Altase and Kum Vaase, and it's legally allowed to withdraw a respirator. But if the family says we don't allow to withdraw the respirator, so they sometimes cover it up by saying we are just weaning the person from the respirator and see what's happening. But they know that there's no chance that he will survive without it. So I'm not talking about this case. I'm talking about a real medical situation where the patient is doing a little better and you are weaning him off the respirator. Now you took him off the respirator, and after 24 hours, he again collapses. Is there a chiyuv to put him back on the respirator or not? So Avshalom Zalman paskened that if 24 hours went by that he was breathing on his own, and now he deteriorated, that's a new event. And as, when there is a new event, you are allowed to withhold the respirator.
If he asked.
If
that's what he instructed, the patient.
If instructed, or if medically you think that there's no real chance, even if you intubate him, it just will prolong his suffering. So that is what we usually do in Shahar Tzedek and in other hospitals. If we wean the patient and enough time elapsed and he is stable, and then something happens that he deteriorates, we are not mechuyev to put him on. I asked of Shlomo Zalman, why 24 hours? Where does it come from? What about 12 hours? Let's say he was stable for 12 hours. So he said that it's only a svore. He doesn't have any source to say that 24 hours means that it's a new event and 12 hours, it's still a continuation. That's a svore. But he told me that if the patient is really stable for 12 hours, he would agree to this as well. But it seemed to me then that less than that, he would regard it as a continuation of the same process. The weaning turned out not to be successful, and therefore you have to put him back on the respirator. So that is one way that one can go about if indeed there is an option for weaning. A second option, again, from Shlomo Zalman's position, happened through a case. There was a case in Hadassah, in Yerushalayim, where there used to be once a president of Israel by the name of Yitzhak Navon, and his wife had very spread metastatic breast cancer. She was suffering terribly. In those days, palliative medicine was not as good as it is today. She was obviously intubated. She got the best treatment possible, the first lady of the country, and that kept her going on and suffering. So the president went to the doctors and told them, I don't want my wife to suffer anymore, but I don't want to do anything against halacha. find me a way that she shouldn't suffer, but it will be according to halacha. He was not a frum person, but he was a Sfaradi, and he was traditional. So what what option do you have? She's intubated. Less than that you can't do. And while she's intubated, she's continuing to live. And as she continues to live, she continues to suffer. So they asked me if I have any idea, the doctors. I said, I don't know. I can't allow to disconnect the patient. But I went to Shlomo Zalman. I told him the story. So I remember him telling me, how much oxygen are you breathing right now? When I was in his room. In Yerushalayim, it's probably less than 21%, let's say 20 or maybe even 19%, but the average is 21%. So he said, why should she have 100%? You can reduce it to 21% and keep her on 21%. Why does she need a pressure of such and such PEEP? You can reduce it, and he went over all kinds of parameters of the respirator, and in his opinion, you're not allowed to disconnect the respirator, but you don't have to give the full treatment as if there's still chances. And then, if she will deteriorate, you're not mechuyev to pick up the parameters, and then she'll die, even though you didn't disconnect her from the respirator. So that's what I told the doctors. I think it took about 24 hours after everything was reduced, and she passed away. So I went back to Shlomo Zalman, and I told him what happened, and I asked him if I am allowed to publish it, because that's a very useful way to treat such situations. So he said he doesn't allow me to publish it, not that he's not sure that this, according to him, is the right halacha, and if there will be another case like this and I'll come to him, he'll tell me the same, but it's innovative, he doesn't know if other poskim would agree with him, it needs more thinking, and in the meantime, it shouldn't be published as a publication, but whoever will come to him, he'll say the same. So I pressed a little bit, because I thought it was very important tool. So I asked him, what will it take that you should agree? So he said, if another poisek will agree with me, I'll consider. I knew that if I'll go to Abel Yashiv, the answer would be no. That I assumed. So I went to Rav Osner, and I told Rav Osner the whole story and what Shlomo Zalman said. So he said, I agree with him, except for one point. And that is, if to reduce, to do it gradually. Because if you will reduce from 100 to 21 at once, this by itself may kill the patient. So reduce it to 80%, wait, if the patient is stable, reduce it to 60%, until the patient becomes unstable and stop there. But otherwise, the process, he accepted. So I went back to Shlomo Zalman and I told him that I went to Rav Osner, and Rav Osner agrees with you. He said, very nice, but I said he had one qualification, and this is what he said. So he told me, you see, I was right that I didn't let you publish, because he's right, and if you would have published the way I said it, it would be wrong, and it has to be this way. So I said, okay, so now can I publish it? He said, absolutely, publish in his name. But at the end, he agreed, and Rav Osner agreed, and I published it. And again, we are doing it occasionally. It's not every case, but that's another option that one can consider in such difficult cases. A third option is a timer. A timer means that you put a timer on the respirator while you start it at the beginning. And let's say you set it up for 5 days and you see how the patient is doing. If the patient is improving, then you stop it and you let it continue. If the patient is deteriorating, you let it run its course. The timer stops the machine and the patient will die, not because I did an act. And conceptually, it's similar to a Shabbos clock. What do? We're not allowed to put on or off light on Shabbos, but we put a priori a timer that puts on and off the electricity by my setup. I did it. I was the grommer for it. And everyone, except for Moshe, everyone accepts the concept of a Shabbos clock, so why should it be different here? So we went to some of the Rabbonim with this idea. I had a written shaila to Rav Zilberstein, and he agreed that you can put such a timer. Moshe Sternbuch has a tshuva in Tshuvot V'Hanagot that he also agrees to it. But the one that initiated the concept was the Tzitz Eliezer. And the Tzitz Eliezer was asked by the then director of Shaare Tzedek, David Meir. They didn't know about a timer, and I'll explain to you in a minute. It's not so simple as it sounds. But he talked about the Shabbos clock. In those days, and probably some of you remember, there was a regular clock that was winded, and you tie the string to the switch, and when it came to the right time, the clock pulled the switch and closed it or opened it, depending on the direction. So he suggested to put such a clock on a respirator, attach it to the switch, and at a certain time, it will pull, and the switch will be off. And Rav Wallenberg agreed to it. I had a shaila on Rav Wallenberg on that because Rav Wallenberg was of the shit of the minority poskim that there is no option but to continue to treat everyone to the end degree, whether he's suffering, whether he doesn't want, whether it's only a day, whether it's costly, no matter what. And so I asked him, if you have to treat him anyway, so let's say that the timer shut off the respirator. According to your shita, you have to put it on again. What did you gain? Because if you shut it off, he will die now. And if you put it again, he will live another day. So you have to do it anyway. So how does the Shabbos clock help according to your shita? But I didn't get an answer to this. But according to most shittas, that you are allowed to withhold certain treatments and let a patient die, provided there's nothing else to do, and he's suffering, and he wants it, and so on. So from this point of view, that would be a good option. The problem is technical. And the technical problem is that the machines today are very sophisticated, and they are built in such a way that, let's say, there is electricity shortage. If the machine will be totally dependent on the electricity, all patients will die. So the machine knows that if there is no input from the electricity, a battery is kicked in and the machine continues to work, even though there was a shortage. So the same here, if you put a regular Shabbos clock, it will pull the switch, but the machine will restart because she doesn't know that you don't want it now. For her, something happened in the electricity and she kicks it. So it has to be very sophisticated to overcome all these technologies and to be safe. It shouldn't happen by accident when you don't want it to happen and many other things. So we did a prototype of such a timer, which worked very well on a doll. But since it is a medical experiment on human beings, you need to do it on a human being. And the IRB's protocol is that you need the consent of the patient to become part of the experiment. But almost all patients on respirator can't give consent. They are unconscious, they can't talk, they don't understand. So it's almost impossible to get a consent. So we are stuck now at a stage where we have the prototype of the machine, but the IRB doesn't let us test it because of lack of consent, and we'll have to find a patient that is still awake and alert and intubated and is willing to go through it. That's complicated. But hopefully one day that will happen. So these are some of the options that can be taken into account if the patient is already on a respirator and you can't switch him off, but you can use some other ways to do it. The last option, which is...
If it's already in, could we use timer? How could we use timer if it's already in?
If what?
If it's already intubated.
Yeah.
Use timer? He's already intubated.
No, you... Before you time it, before you intubate, the machine has already the timer.
It should be beginning.
Yeah, like a Shabbos clock on Friday. Right, you don't put the Shabbos clock on Shabbos. So if you do it before you intubated him, it will be automatically part of the machine, of the respirator, and you just adjust the timing, whatever you want, a day, 5 days, a week, doesn't matter. And then you intubate him with this machine that has already the timer. And the last option, which is a practical option, is that in the old days, oxygen didn't come from the wall. Oxygen was supplied by a tank of oxygen. So the respirator was attached to a tank. The tank provided the oxygen. And when the oxygen finished in the tank, you replaced the tank. Nowadays, it is plugged to the wall, and oxygen is flowing all the time. There's no stoppage. There's no time that there's no oxygen and you have to replace something. So what you can do today, if you want to stop the respirator in a way that halachically would be permissible, is to detach the respirator from the wall, attach it to a balloon, to a tank of oxygen, like you do when you take a patient who is on a respirator to the rentgen or to the OR. You have to move him. You can't move the wall with him to go somewhere. You detach it from the wall and you attach it to a tank. Now, that was already a long time at Tshuva by Rav Moshe, that if the tank finished, there's no chiyuv to replace it. So that is another way to take him off the wall, put him on a tank, let it go until the tank is finished, and not replace the tank.
You can have him on already on the wall and then switch it to a
Yeah,
tank.
Why not? You do it all the time.
Why is it not different than putting a timer in once it's already...
What?
Why is it not different than putting a timer on already once it's already connected, to put a timer on in the middle?
Well, because that's like putting a timer on Shabbos to put on and off. Because then there is already... Chalut of the Isur. So that's, maybe you are right. Maybe it can be done even then. But certainly it's better if it's done a priori. Then it's not directly doing an act that leads to this situation.
And is a tank more than an hour or two?
Yeah, it can be a few hours. Depends on the...
So we're talking about a short
depends how big it is and depends how much oxygen you need.
I know, but the most tank is very... We're talking about a short-term thing, not a week.
No, not a week. It's a matter of hours, but it doesn't matter. As long as it goes, it goes. And
going back to Vosner's answer, he said that you gradually decrease oxygen, and then, but at each interval, you have to wait to see if the patient is stable. How long did he say they need to wait before putting it down to the next level? I mean, how long do they have to wait to see?
Well, they didn't specify a time, but usually when you have a patient of this kind and you see all his parameters and they look stable, when you reduce, it still is totally stable, reduce a little bit. So you wait minutes, maybe an hour, just to see that there are no major changes. And if it's this way, you continue. Once you reach a level that it becomes unstable, then you have to bring it up to the last stable parameter and you leave it there.
What if the patient has informed you from moment one, before he got sick, when I get sick, I just don't want any heroic acts, which we'll call this heroic.
So then...
And the Hatzalah didn't know this.
Right.
They did intubation, and now what do you do?
Now he's stuck.
Well, not totally, right?
Except for these measures. But The wish of the patient, halachically, I'm not talking about the secular approach. Secular approach is different. But halachically, a patient may wish what is permissible halachically. So he can say, I don't want you to intubate me. I don't want you to put me on dialysis. I don't want you to give me chemotherapy. That's fine. If he fulfills certain parameters.
What can't he tell you then? What would be forbidden for him to tell you?
No, no, it's okay.
Halachically,
that is okay. But if he tells you, even if you intubate me, I want you to extubate me, that he can't say. Even if he says, it doesn't apply. Or if he tells you, I don't want you to feed me. Halachically, you can't stop feeding because that's committing suicide. He's dying of hunger, not of disease.
There are certain times where giving the nutrition to the patient can be damaging.
Right. If it's a medical indication to stop feeding or fluid, then it's like any medical procedure. But if medically you can continue, but philosophically you say, why prolong his life, halachically, there's no chance.
Dialysis is heroic?
No, we don't use heroic term. Every treatment that is beneficial and can help, it's
if
a treatment.
Somebody said they don't want dialysis.
If someone doesn't want dialysis and he is going to die of renal failure, he fulfills the criteria, he is a dying patient, he's suffering, he doesn't want, you don't put him on dialysis. Moreover,
if he's on and he wants to be taken off.
Yeah, so moreover, according to Shlomo Zalman, again, a very important chiddush of his, he distinguished between treatment that are continuous as opposed to treatments that are cyclic. A cyclic treatment, such as dialysis, how do you treat a patient on dialysis? You invite him Sunday morning, you hook him up for 4 hours to the dialysis machine, you take him off the machine. He's not permanently on the machine. On a Tuesday, he comes for another cycle. According to Shlomo Zalman, each cycle is a new decision. So if you give him now the cycle, you can't stop it in the middle. But once it's stopped, because this is how you treat him, and the next time you don't want to give him, you can say that's withholding treatment. Whereas a respirator is a continuous treatment. You can't say, I'll give it for 4 hours and I'll give him later again. Obviously, he won't come later, right? So these are the very important distinctions.
So to take him off the respirator when they're cleaning it is not allowed.
Oh, so there was a suggestion that even when there is a suctioning procedure during the respiratory treatment, you stop the respirator in order to do the suction and you reconnect. That, according to most poskim, maybe you can find some who would say that that's also an interruption, but that is part of the treatment. It's not
12 hours.
So they want to allow to not continue just because you stopped it for a minute to do suction. There's another situation which also is debatable, and that is when there are questions of priority. Let's say you have a patient on a respirator. In the COVID pandemic, you took a patient who needed a respirator, you put him on a respirator, he is deteriorating, he is not doing well, he probably won't survive, and now comes someone who needs a respirator and has a chance to survive if you will get the respirator, but there are no respirators available. Are you allowed to take it off this person, knowing that you are doing an act that he will die sooner, but he anyway doesn't have a chance, and give it to the one that has a chance, and at least he will survive? So Zalman Lechemia thought that you're allowed to do it, but many others disagreed.
What's the
head? Ein doch nefesh v'nei nefesh. Right. But since you are not killing him, you are doing a sort of a groma. It's not a direct killing. He doesn't die instantaneously. He will die after a while. And this one, you're right, that most hold that you can't do it. But I'm saying, according to Zalman Lechemia, that would be permissible. In very unique situation.
If a patient is pulling it out himself, he's suffering. Somebody last week called from here that the patient wants to pull it out.
If he pulled it out and for 12 hours, 24 hours, he was stable, then you don't need to reintubate. It's like winning. But if after an hour he fails, then you have to reintubate.
You'd have to tie down his hands?
You have to?
Tie down his hands?
He's pulling. If needed, yes. Yes. I mean, otherwise it's suicide. I mean, he's killing himself.
According to Rav Shlomo Zalman, that the Rebbe has been quoting, the 12 hours or 24 hours, so was Rav Shlomo Zalman comfortable with taking them off of the oxygen from the wall and putting them into it, putting it into a tank which didn't have the capacity to last 12 hours? So you're initiating a situation where you know this patient is not going to have a sufficient amount of oxygen. Was Rav Shlomo Zalman comfortable with that?
I don't know. I never discussed with him this, but the Moshe was comfortable with it.
Why did you need all of, why did, I mean, if you have the tank suggestion, how?
Right, so I mean,
it seems like the best thing.
Not everyone agrees with everyone, so I'm giving you a variety of options depending on who you ask. But the idea is that we don't allow to withdraw a respirator, but yet there might be options in appropriate circumstances that you can use.
What about the feeding tube? Can a patient say, I do not want a feeding tube?
No. I mean, a patient can say, I don't want a feeding tube, but you'll have to provide food in a different way. Let's say put him a peg, give him an IV. Feeding tube is very uncomfortable. So some would say,
I don't want that.
I understand that I need to be fed, but I don't want an NG tube. That is legitimate, so you'll have to find a different way. If he will say, I don't want any food, no matter if it's NG or by mouse or a peg or an IV, I don't want that. So here there's a machloikes between Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman if the patient is conscious. He may have said it earlier, now he's unconscious, and the family said, he said he doesn't want to be fed, so don't feed him. That doesn't apply at all, because now he's not opposing. He said it once. We don't know what he thinks now. And in any event, you are not imposing on him because he's unconscious. But if he's still competent and he says, I don't want you to feed me in any way, what do you do in this case? So Shlomo Zalman says you have to force it. You have to tie him, you have to put in food, because that's a suicide. If someone goes up on the 20th floor and says, I'm going to jump. You'll say, okay, be my guest and jump because that's what you want to do. You'll try to hold him, right? So if he says, I want to commit suicide by not eating, so you have to feed him even by force. Moshe has an interesting take on that, which I admit I don't understand. He says that if you will force such a patient to eat, that will hasten his death because psychologically he won't be able to take it. I don't know of any study that shows that this is what happens if you force feed someone, that he psychologically is dying sooner. I don't know. I don't know where he took it from, but that's not a halachic source. It's a svore. And Shlomo Zalman said he doesn't know such svores. He knows that if he won't be fed, he'll die. And therefore, I have to feed him, no matter how. So that is a machloikis. By the way, Rav Schechter says that you can stop food and fluid anyway in a dying patient, which, again, I don't understand it, but that's his clear position.
So Schechter's saying, if the patient says?
If the patient says, or maybe even if the situation is that he's dying, and by feeding him, you are prolonging his suffering. It's like putting him on a respirator or doing any other treatment. Whereas the other poskim say, food and fluid is not a treatment. It's sustenance. We all need food and fluid, even if we're not dying. So therefore, it's different than a form of treatment. But he apparently views it as another form of treatment, and he holds that you can stop it. That's what I hear. I didn't hear it from directly, but I hear from people that was his position, is his position.
So all of these haterim basically are working with a patient who's bitzar and chayeshoah. Those are the criteria. Who's suffering and it's chayeshoah.
Right.
How do we define suffering?
Because most of these patients that are right. ventilated are going to be anyways.
So that again is a machlokes between Rabbi Eliashiv on the one hand and Rabbi Moshe Shlomo Zalman on the other hand. Rabbi Eliashiv says that whether he is chayishu or not, suffering is defined by us seeing that he is suffering. If he tells us, then we know that he is suffering. If he can't tell us, so he is fidgety and he is crying and he is yelling. You see that he is suffering. But if he is comatose and quiet,
sedated
or in a persistent vegetative state or whatever situation that we don't see that he is suffering, then he's not suffering. So here, there is a hechatimtze, which is very strange. Usually, the closer he gets to death, the less is an obligation to prolong his life, right? If he is far from dying yet, but he is conscious, or he shows pain and suffering, you stop treating him, and he will die. But if he overcame this stage, and now he's getting closer to die, but he becomes comatose, you have to treat him in a full treatment because now he's not suffering. It's a little strange. But from Zalman and Reb Moshe say that any dying patient, by definition, is suffering. It's an existential suffering, whatever philosophy they invoke. And I remember from Zalman told me once, it sounds like a vote, but it's a concept. He said, the Gemara says that Beitzias and Neshoma Koy lo hoylech misofo olam v'ad sofo. So he told me, you are a physician, you probably witnessed people dying. Did you ever hear such a noise misofo olam v'ad sofo? Chazal said that this is so, so it's so. The fact that you didn't hear is your problem. So the fact that we don't see the suffering doesn't mean that he's not suffering. He may suffer, but we don't see. We have limits. Chazal foresaw things that we can't comprehend. But the idea is that you can say it by definition. That's their position. Yes?
The Rav said before, the Shem Rav Shlomo Zalman, that if somebody's already on dialysis, or Shlomo Zalman, Rav expressed that it's a chiddush that they could deny treatment if they
What would be the scar of not like that? What would be the scar that they would have to continue? Meaning, after dialysis, there's no toxic left in their blood. It's almost like their health. They end up with toxic built up again. So they need to have another dialysis. What would be a scar, the person would have to take the next dialysis treatment? The scar is either the thing medically that he still may have a chance, and then obviously you have to give a chance, but everyone agrees. Or the Al people, and Moshe Zalman is very respectful of such people, that say that for them, every minute of life, Goyle Mazze, is very important, even if they want to live longer. Many times, families say it in the name of their next of kin, do everything possible, prolong their life, because every minute of life is worth. Then, it's not acceptable by most poskim because the family is not the person. And if he's suffering and by halachic criteria you're allowed to stop his suffering, they are not entitled to prolong his suffering. That's the Maaseh of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the Amsei de Rebbe. There are a lot of sources of this kind. But if the person himself says, for me it's important, Yisurim emarkim, I don't mind that I have Yisurim, I want to stay in this world, I want to come purer to the next world. All kinds of machshoves that people have, then by all means you should continue. But if we don't know, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, chazoke, that people don't want to suffer at the end of life, and if halachically you can shorten their suffering, then why not?
In the case of the timer, can they just get a power of attorney from the family? If they, I don't know if it's in there, it's just the same.
Yes,
way.
Yes, yes. You can get a power of attorney, but again, halachically speaking, the power of attorney is excellent to handle end of life according to what the one that is the surrogate understands that is what his next of kin would like to. But he doesn't have a power to override aloche. So if he will say, I know that my father or my my mother didn't want to be on a respirator, even if you put her on a respirator and I want you to disconnect, halachically, that's invalid. Legally, it's valid in this.
But
in
the
this
timer,
country.
The timer thing is now a different. It's a different zach.
The once timer?
We're using this new.
Yeah, but there's no timer at the moment.
So I'm saying because the IRB is not letting it go through.
Right.
But if we say I have a power of attorney that says we can let it go through.
Ah, you mean if the consent will be by the power of attorney?
Right.
So at least in Israel, the IRB thought that it is such a dramatic invention that it's a matter of life and death, right? If this stops, he dies. That is not sufficient that someone else should consent for you. You have to consent. I think it's a chumrah in the ethical sphere, but that's what they want.
I'm just curious, the battery doesn't run out after a certain point? Like the machine has its own battery?
Which battery?
The regular respirators, they have their own battery? So it will continue going even after it gets disconnected?
Yeah, but usually power comes back. It's not that power.
But if the timer turns it off, so the
battery. So the timer has to overcome the adjustment to the battery. That's what it is, a complicated technological measure. But we were successful to do it. As I said, on a Dal, it worked well. It overcame the whole circuit.
I'm saying on the regular ones now, the battery will have its own limit. No, even if after it gets disconnected from
the wall. if the electricity went off, mm-hmm. and there is and you rely on the battery, you can rely only until a certain period of time. But in the meantime, you'll fix it. You don't.
Someone intentionally puts up a timer now.
Yeah.
So why? So once the timer disconnects and it's relying on the battery has a limit. After some time, it will die out, wouldn't it? The regular machines that we have now, if someone puts a timer.
No, the timer, if it will work, will be such that once the switch is off, the machine will not go to the battery.
Right. But if it does go to the battery, there's a limit how many hours.
Yeah, but that's the whole concept of this timer, that it won't go there.
Okay.
Okay. So that is on this issue. Now, just yesterday and today, I got two questions on two scenarios. One is, yesterday from Colombia, a doctor called me up. He's a cardiologist, and he has a patient that already for a number of years, it's known that he has coronary artery stenosis. The coronary arteries that supply blood to the heart are blocked. And if they'll become fully blocked, he will die. Because if there's no blood supply to the heart, there'll be a heart attack, and he will die. And there is a procedure that's called CABG, which is they take a vein or an artery for another part of the body, and they circumvent the blockage. So if this is the coronary artery, in here it's blocked, so they attach one side of the new vein or artery before the block and one after, and then blood can flow to the heart even though this is blocked.
It's a bypass, isn't it?
What?
It's a bypass.
Sort of a bypass, right. So that's called CABG. Doesn't matter. That's a procedure. It's relatively simple. It's not an open-heart surgery. But he refused it. And he has it on child that he refuses the operation. And they try to convince him, and several times it's written in the child that whatever attempts were made, he refuses. Now, 3 days ago, he got a heart attack, a major heart attack. He became unconscious. He was intubated, and he's now unconscious. And if now the surgery will not be done, then he's going to die. So he asked me if they can overcome his previous refusal, because now he's not refusing. We know that he said before that he refuses, but now he doesn't. So can they do the surgery overcoming what he said before? So I thought that halachically speaking, and obviously it can't be done by law in this country, but halachically speaking, I think that one could have even enforced the surgery while he was still competent, because there is a moruktsia in Siman Shin Kafchet that says, he talks there apparently from the description on a diabetic patient who has a gangrenous leg. And in order to save his life, you have to amputate the leg. If you don't amputate, he will die. If you amputate, he will live, and certainly if it's below knee, so he will have a prosthesis and he can live very well. So says the Moroktsia that you have to enforce it on him to save his life. He is not a balabos on his own body and life, and he decides to act in a way that will kill him, he's not allowed to do it. So you can enforce it. So I don't see any difference between a CABG procedure on someone who's going to die from a heart attack or amputating a leg that is going to die from the infection of the gangrenous leg. On the contrary, I think it's a much safer and easier procedure than amputating a leg. So according to the Moroktsia, certainly he could be enforced. But ethically, you can't override his autonomy. He says, I don't want. In this country, there's no way to override his autonomy. But now that he is unconscious, so we can make all kinds of calculations. Maybe now he regretted. He can change his mind, but you can't ask him. Maybe now he understands how severe the situation is and he would think differently. So you can invoke all kinds of calculations and do the procedure.
Wouldn't the surgeon then open himself up not only to a lawsuit but to a disciplinary proceeding where he could lose
right.
his license?
So that was the question that he asked, if halachically there is an obligation and if practically it can be done. Now, there is an ongoing serious debate in a different scenario, and one of them happened just recently in Israel that caused the latest war, and that is a hunger striker. Hunger strikers strike for an ideology, and they don't want to be fed. They went so far, this last one, that he died. And because of it, the whole riot started, and there was a whole war. I argued that you shouldn't force him, you should feed him by force, because he is not an owner of his body to die of hunger, and you can feed him by force. So it was the same situation, and the medical establishment in Israel ethically thought that you can't enforce, but they agreed that once he loses conscious, you can use this opportunity and say maybe he changed his mind. In this case, it was too late because he was so cachectic and so deprived for so long that even when they tried to feed him, it didn't help, and he died. My opinion was that they should have done it much earlier, but then he was still conscious. So that is the dilemma. So it's a similar dilemma. So I told him, I can't ask in you what the American scenario would say on an unconscious person that you know before that he disagreed. So they wanted to go to a ethics committee of the hospital. It was in Colombia, and see what they think about it. In the meantime, he woke up, and they asked. They told him, "You see what happened? It will be worse. It may cause your death. Do you agree to do the cabbage?" He said, "Yes, I'm willing to do." So I told them that the lesson learned from this, I think even from a halachic point of view, it was to me clear that he should have been treated, and here he even agreed. But from an ethical point of view, what happens, I think, in most situations as such in the United States, maybe because of fear of malpractice and all kinds of other irrelevant to the medical situation, if a patient says, I refuse a treatment, they write it down in the chart, the patient refuses treatment, they don't treat him, and he dies. That is the normal situation. But I told him that I think this is wrong, because a person can say, I don't want, and not really mean it. A person can have something on his mind now, something transient, he feels no good, he remembers someone else who had it and it was complicated, or whatever. And the real autonomy is to sit with him and try to explain to him what is pro, what is con, what are the consequences, and so on, and not let it go, not leave it, okay, I marked it in the chart, I'm going to another patient, I forgot from it. Come back to him, try to influence him, try to convince him, because it turns out that once he understood what's happening, he really wanted it. It's like in a get, a koifin al a get, because actually he wants it. He wants to do the right thing. He just, for whatever reason, he says the wrong thing. So I think it's a mistake, even from an autonomy point of view. What?
Because they're so concerned about suffering, which you pointed out before. People don't want to suffer.
Yeah, but this is not a dying situation. This is a patient that if you do the operation, he can live normal life. Once you do the bypass, he can live normally. Well, everyone is undergoing. Most people would like it. There are some who want to die, but you have to understand them.
If somebody attempts suicide unsuccessfully, he's brought into the hospital unconscious, every hospital will treat him.
Right.
He committed suicide. He said he wants to die.
He said he doesn't want to live, yet you treat him. So I think that is a way to get out. So But the interesting point was that while we are discussing, he wakes up and he says, yes, I'm willing. So the whole discussion went by. And a second case from this morning, which I'm not sure what the answer is, it's a twin pregnancy, 28 weeks of gestation, that have one placenta, so they are identical twins. And there is a syndrome which occurs between 10 and 20% of identical twins, which is called TTTS, which is twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, which means that occasionally one twin is putting more blood to the other twin rather than being equally distributed by blood. So as long as they are equally getting the blood, they are equally growing, the same weight and the same size, and both of them can survive and be delivered. That's how most twins are delivered. But sometimes, for some aberrant vessels that are in the placenta, one twin is transfusing his blood to the other twin. And that endangers both twins, because the twin that gives his blood to the other twin is losing blood and he can't grow. And the twin that gets too much blood develops cardiac failure. The heart can't take care of so much blood. So both are liable to die. So there is now a procedure done through ultrasound with a laser that they catheterize certain blood vessels from one to the other, and they stop the flow from one twin to the other twin. And the mother refuses to undergo this procedure. She's afraid it will cause harm, maybe they'll catheterize the not right vessel, and all kinds of things. The second question that came up was, when is the right timing to do it? Because there are side effects to the procedure. One of them is that it may induce abortion, the procedure by itself. So if the babies are now 28 weeks of gestation, and if they'll do the procedure and the children will be born, they'll be born very prematurely, and then they'll suffer for the rest of their lives. 20 weeks of gestation are a lot of complications, cerebral palsy, mental retardation, and so on. If you wait too long, let's say wait until 32 weeks or 34 weeks, that even if there will be induction of labor, there will be already mature babies and they won't suffer consequences, maybe it will be too late for their health due to the transfusion. So there are a lot of complicated calculations which are partially medical, partially emotional, and partially halachic maybe. I don't know the answer because I don't know enough. It just came before you came to pick me up. I need to know more about all the chances and what centers do what. And it's not.
What are they asking? What's the shaila that they're asking?
The shaila is, A, how to overcome the mother's objection. B, is it the right time to do it now or to do it later? And C, is it really beneficial more than not doing anything? So C, the answer is clear. If you don't do anything, there's 90% chance they won't survive because they started it very early and they won't survive. So certainly it has to be done. But if it has to be done, should you do it now because there's less damage to the twins, but if it will induce labor, they'll be very preemie? Or should you do it later so that even if there'll be induction of labor, they'll be more mature, but maybe it will be too late because already the damage will... It's complicated. So I'm saying, this is a medical shaila, but you get different answers. Because it is not... It's a new procedure, relatively new procedure. There are not many centers that know how to do it. And it depends. They went to several centers and they got different opinions. So the question is, who do you rely more?
One baby doesn't have a din of a Rodfim. The one that's giving the extra blood.
Both are Rodfim. Because
the one's giving the extra blood
right.
is the one that's causing the other one to have too much blood.
Right.
The other one that's
but he is also losing blood
not,
by
giving... But the other one's not doing it there.
Right.
So one baby that's doing it is the right.
Okay, the so if you go in this direction, so the solution would be abort the one that is droning blood.
Both. Yeah, okay.
No, otherwise...
I'm asking it that...
No, I'm saying, so that is the conclusion. The question leads to a conclusion, right? If you call him Roidev, you kill.
Is he Roidev?
No, so I'm saying, Roidev, you kill. Right. But the halacha of Roidev is that if you can save the life by other means without killing the Roidev, you should do it.
Right.
So here there's certainly another way.
There might be another way.
But the mother's
no,
objecting.
There is another way.
But the mother's objecting.
But the mother's objecting. So
she's the
so again. So again, should we enforce it on her, the treatment?
The answer would be yes.
What?
The government won't allow it.
Right. I'm talking halachically. Halachically, should we enforce it on her because she's not damaged at all? I mean, that's a simple
she's
procedure.
She's damaging the babies.
But no, I'm saying if we do the procedure, we don't hurt her at all.
So why is she refusing? It's just why should psychological.
Okay, so now we have to look into all... I'm saying this is this came just now. So these are the questions.
Wouldn't you say that you have to force her?
So halachically, yes. But from a legal, ethical point of view, you can do it. Right.
Sometimes you can give a halachic answer and your hands are tied behind your back.
Right. Okay, so are we there already? Or are the other... I'm bringing something very, very current.
The biggest shaila is probably when.
That's the big shaila. That's a medical shaila.
Right, that's the biggest
right. shaila. So sometimes when you have a medical shaila and there are different opinions, so you go according to the boki, you go according to the rov, right. Like in Yom Kippur. We know when there is a dispute amongst physicians, one say she has, you have to eat, one says no. So there are rules. How do you go about it? If the boki is a minority, or the majority says differently, what do you prefer? You prefer the boki, you prefer the majority? There are rules on that, how to go halachically. So these are halachic.
But halachically, it's clear, right, that you would have to force her.
In my view, yes.
There's no shaila.
In my view.
Legally, you can.
Yeah, your hands are tied behind your back.
In this particular case, is it equal if they would... Let's say he has a din of a Rodfim, the baby number one, and the second one has a better chance of surviving if you knock off fetus number one. I mean, that might complicate...
If what?
Meaning, is it equal when they do this procedure to do the snipping of the of the artery, of these connecting points? Is that 50-50 whether the child, both of them are going to survive?
No, there's a high percentage that both will survive. hypertension. I don't know to tell you the number exactly. It depends on how severe the situation is at the moment. But it's a very high percentage that both will be delivered alive and well.
But would it be better if for baby number two, would it be better if you knocked off baby number one? Would
that not necessarily. Change? If you stop the blood from baby number one, it won't affect it. Why? He doesn't care why the blood isn't coming into him anymore.
But if you take in regard to the fact that there's a chance it will be born early,
right.
Take that in consideration, that it would be better for baby number two to...
Right. That's another consideration, that if it will cause an early birth, then both will suffer being preemies. So it's better to wait. Excuse me, but if you wait, maybe it will be too late for the damage that was already occurring.
There's no way of monitoring it constantly to see.
No, you can't. Yeah, you can monitor, yes, you're right. You weigh, right. You do a calculation of weight. It's not never exact, but you can. Again, it's all within a medical sphere, but if we come to a situation where one center says do it now, and one center says do it later, or one center says do it this way or that way, where do you go? So if you go to Reb Chaim Zatzal, he'll tell you Beruach HaKodesh, who is a better center. If you go, but halachically speaking, it's a shaila. It's like the shailas of Machloikes HaRofim. The issue of Roidev that you mentioned was applicable to a famous tshuva of Rav Moshe in a Siamese twins. There was a case of Siamese twins that they were connected throughout the body, and they had in combination 6 chambers of heart rather than 8. So that one baby had 4 chambers, like it has to be, and the other one had only 2. And he was smaller and attached to the one that had the full heart. And it was clear that the one that had the full heart couldn't carry the additional twin. So that was a shaila that the Surgeon General of the United States, who was a pediatric surgeon, needed to do the operation. And the operation would have been to sacrifice the smaller one. And he thought ethically it's a major problem. And they referred the shaila to Reb Moshe. And Reb Moshe, for 3 days, didn't eat and didn't drink and was looking into it, and finally came to the conclusion that indeed it's a roidev, and he allowed to sacrifice the smaller one for the...
Who turned to Reb Moshe?
Hmm?
The government?
Yeah, the Surgeon General. I mean, maybe the family turned.
Oh. It wasn't Surgeon General, he was in Chubb. In Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania, he later became Surgeon
General. Right, I mean, the person who was Surgeon
General. Dr. Coop,
yeah. And he said he is waiting until the little man in the Lower East Side will say what to do.
He didn't survive.
The big baby survived.
He was worried that he'd be a writer. He went to the courts to make sure the courts wouldn't try him as a Ritzea.
Because he's going to kill one of the babies
on the operating table.
So that is a real roidev because there's no other options. But here there's another option, and in roidev the halacha is that if you can save him be'echad me'evorav, you don't kill him.
It's not lavdavka because you don't know what will be either way.
Right. Anyway, so that is very fresh. Yes.
The Rav is going to speak about medical marijuana and CBD and Yik on Friday. Looking around the room, more than 20 rabbis, I think the only one who's privileged to hear that is Rabbi Moskin.
No, Rabbi Weiner also.
Rabbi Weiner too. So since as a psychologist, I get this question on a weekly basis, and I know a number of rabbis has also asked me and others, and Lo Matzani Yodinu Raglenu on this issue, and especially also psychedelics, mushrooms, people are using it massing b'chol yom. I wanted to hear from the Rav if it's okay, if the Rav Moskin allows for us for the preview, since I don't think it's going to be recorded on Shavuos.
Right.
So.
No, so just briefly, there is a...
And the oxygen.
Well, I'll try to explain what the difference is between all these types of addictions and what they do, and it's an extensive discussion, but there, hardly any of the poskim related directly to addiction from a halachic point of view. I assume because they assume it's also, and they don't have to write anything. And Moshe has a short tshuva on that, and he says, obviously, it's also for many reasons, and simply because it causes damage, it causes addiction and waste of time, and all kinds of considerations that he brings. They'll bring it at the meeting. But some of the substances are not psychedelic. Some of the marijuana or grass or there's many names, hashish and so on. So there are many, many parts to it, but there's one part that is regarded as not psychedelic. It doesn't cause to be high. And that has also medical qualities, which certainly are allowed. For instance, it is very potent in pain killing. So many cancer patients take it so that they won't feel the pain. It's very potent, and it's probably less damaging than morphine. And sometimes it's preferable over morphine. It also has therapeutic effects on some of the diseases. We are now studying it on epilepsy, and it seems to be in certain epilepsies beneficial. It's probably beneficial to other diseases. So obviously when it's done as a medical marijuana, then there's no question that it should be mutar. Moshe doesn't discuss it, but that seems to be clear that if it's done for the right purpose, it's like any other medication. And if we know that it's less addictive than the other parts, then it's certainly better. Avil Yashiv has a tshuva that even the psychedelic part of marijuana is permissible for a dying patient. A patient who is dying, what are you afraid of, that he'll become addicted? He's going to die anyway, so he'll be addicted for a while. But in the meantime, he's in a different dream. It helps him. Why not? So he has an interesting tshuva that you're allowed to give it to a dying patient. Obviously, he didn't mean to give it freely to people to be on high.
That's also medical.
It's also medical in a way, medical, psychological, but it's medical. But today, the issue is that people claim that marijuana or hashish are not addictive, and therefore, even for social reasons, you just want to be a little high, you had a rough day, you were a little upset, so you take it and you feel good with yourself. But that certainly is not true, because even if this per se is not addictive, studies have shown that it induced other substances. Once you start with one and you feel good, so they tell you about this, you feel even better. And then you go to something else, and that's how especially young people become addictive to heart drug, heroin, and so on.
I have someone in my community that asked me not too long ago about using it in the bedroom. She said that she suffers from a little anxiety, and therefore it's hard for her to find pleasure out of Tashmish because she's always thinking about things. And someone gave her an edible, and it worked to calm her down and get her in the zone. And since then she's been taking it, and she said that she's feeling very bad about it, so she wanted to know if it was mutter to continue, because that's the only way she could fully...
I think that would be the same as a medical indication for this situation. But she should be careful not to get into it too much, and then if it won't help, she might try something else, and then it becomes an issue.
You said that also one of the new things is psychedelics. I think you mentioned that some states it's actually legal, that for trauma and grief, they're using this on veterans now, that the only treatment they've found is like hardcore psychedelics, LSD and mushrooms, where there is a risk also for some patients. They're starting to find that it's not beneficial, but for the majority, they're finding that it is beneficial. So it's a higher risk, and it's a very potent and dangerous drug. So is that, would that still be medical? Would that be
so medical? Again, if it's a serious post-traumatic stress disorder, and we know now that it is a real symptom. Years ago, soldiers who were in combat, they came back totally disrupted, but they said, nah, that's just psychological, he'll overcome. We know it's not so. And some of them commit suicide, and some of them really don't have a life. They're really, it's a real sickness. So if this is the medication for it, then it seems like, again, it's a medical indication. The fear always is... What?
And you'd follow Rove, right?
Right. But then, the hesitation is that it will lead to more and more. And you get adjusted and you get addicted. Like people who have severe pain after operation, they are given morphine, and then even after everything is okay, they continue to be addicted to morphine. So that is a real fear. But again, it has to be judged per case.
In the case of the marijuana where it's not addictive, we're just worried that it's going to lead to something else. So I've had people say to me, so why is it any different than wine or whiskey and the like?
Right.
You just want to have it, you know, we have whiskey at Kiddush, why can't we just have edibles at Kiddush?
Right.
And why can't we have
So that is the major argument of those who want to legalize marijuana for social reasons. But it seems like that statistically, the addiction rate from marijuana to more potent and forbidden substances are much greater than having even a Kiddush club becoming a drunken alcoholic. It may lead to
Is it true? Because I know in many communities they're struggling with their Kiddush clubs and their alcohol.
No, I think that's a wrong thing to do. But I'm saying,
what's the wrong thing to do?
A Kiddush club. That they come just in order to drink a bottle of whiskey. But again, the distance between becoming addictive to alcohol from such use and becoming addictive to substance from marijuana is quite far.
They have statistics. I would assume statistics. Hmm? They have statistics on this.
Yeah.
It's a gateway drug.
Is CBD part of it? Has it been shown that that part is not
right
problematic? Because that also does still affect the ambition of people. I mean, people in their 30s or 40s have been smoking for the past 20 years. And now they feel like bums because they don't have any more drive or energy because it does kill that part of them.
Right.
Even though it might not be addictive, but it does have side effects.
Whatever you don't need to take, better don't take, whether you know or don't. It's like with smoking. You smoke one or two a day, and it becomes a package and two a day and then more.
The problem is the media and the
interesting, Moshe asked all these marijuana and so on, but he didn't ask for smoking because apparently in his days it wasn't considered to give someone, but yourself he allows because he didn't think that there is such danger as we know today. And an interesting point of Shlomo Zalman Neuerbach, everything was calculated with him, so he said it's preferable not to smoke, but he can't answer it. So they asked him, why not? We know it can cause trouble. He said, if I'll answer it, I might see laws on all the gedolim in previous generations that smoked tremendously. They didn't know what the consequences is. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Shoimer on Chamoyro Shel Pinchas Ben Yoir, Kal Vachomer, that he should have be Shoimer on the Tzadikim and the Gedoylim. How can I say that they did something wrong? So I can't say anything. That was his
That's a remission.
What?
what Rav Shlomo Zalman said on Rav Moshe?
No. His position was.
That's what he said. Rav Moshe.
Right. His position.
I don't know
what he said about him.
If I may.
This will be the last question, and people can ask more about it.
No, another subject, if I may. And I understand this is, this is controversial, and a lot of times it's hard to have an intelligent conversation, but hopefully in this setting it will be an intelligent one, is obviously the issue of vaccination. Now, yes, it goes all over, and people get very, it gets very personal about them. But in general, and if I may, nothing is, if you want to have an intelligent conversation, nothing is black and white. The recent vaccinations, that the research time by definition was very short. And everything in life, you have to make a cheshbon of, sechara keneged hefseda, with the limited schar, that limited success that they have. I just want to hear what is the Rav's position.
I disagree with the assumptions. I think it was very beneficial. I don't think that the pandemic could have saved so many lives without the vaccine. We know what happened up to the vaccine and what happened after the vaccine. Now, the claim, there are many claims against this vaccine which are all refuted, but the claim that it was done quicker than usual is not because they gave up on certain parameters of experiment and they made it easier, and therefore it wasn't tested enough. A vaccine to be tested needs hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people before you know that A, it's effective, and B, it's not damaging, right? Now, in a regular circumstance, polio, measles, whatever vaccine we know, until you gather enough people to test it, it takes a long time. So usually a vaccine is not developed until 3-4 years. Also, it is very costly. And companies that develop vaccines take time to gather all the funding that is needed to produce it. In the COVID pandemic, they were millions right away. It spread so fast that you didn't need time to find people to give them and to experiment. And B, the funding was enormous. The companies got so much money because every government wanted to be sure that they get the vaccine in order to contain the epidemic. So these two factors, which usually prolong the time of experiment, weren't in effect in this particular case. And therefore, they did everything that every experiment requires. No one gave them any halachot,
any leeways
to say, because we are in a pandemic, do a little less or don't pay attention to this and just produce a vaccine. That is wrong. And the most important part is that this vaccine is the first on such a scale that is based on a totally different concept from a biological point of view. So on the one hand, it worried people because we didn't know such a vaccine. How do we know that it works? How would we know that there are no long-term side effects and so on? But even theoretically, this was the best way to produce a vaccine. If you do it by a messenger RNA and not by the virus itself, it is certainly more safe than taking a virus and putting in your body in order to produce antibodies. Here, you take the messenger RNA that produces the antibodies and disappears. After 5 days, there's no remnant from the vaccine part of the messenger RNA, whereas the virus particles of any other vaccine stay much longer. So from all medical scientific aspects, and I'm not an expert in virology, but I looked into it very carefully, and I think scientifically speaking, it was an excellent idea and done the right way. Epidemiologically, I think it proved itself beyond expectation. I mean, here we are sitting now without masks, talking to each other, and Baruch Hashem healthy. And even if, Chas v'Sholom, someone will become sick, it's much milder than it was because we have enough antibodies, either because we had the disease and we recovered, or primarily because we were vaccinated and we have antibodies to protect ourselves from the disease at all, or at least from the severity of the disease. So my private opinion, and as you said, not everyone agrees, but I think my understanding is that it was a very important move. It saved the world, and it should continue that way. And now they are inventing many other vaccines based on the new methodology, which is a much safer one and much more effective. So I don't see...
Would the Rav say one should, like a flu vaccine, get the COVID vaccine every year or whatever the...
Whatever the recommendations will be. I took it 4 or 5 times and I was sick twice. So I am really covered with antibodies throughout my nose.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you to the RCC, to Young Israel, Century City, and to Cedar Sinai. Thank you, Dr. Steinberg. And thank you all for coming. There's still more food. Please help us eat the food there.
We have to bench, and maybe...
Yeah, could we have a minfa? We'll stay for a minfa. Yeah?